Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. Yes, we're still in a pandemic, but for some, it's a time of a dual epidemic for people affected by alcohol or drug addiction. NPR reported the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned last month that the pandemic may have contributed to a rise in deadly drug overdoses. Today, Where We Live, we talk to people in recovery. What's it like navigating addiction in a pandemic when community programs to help people must rely on less face-to-face interaction because of COVID-19? Coming up, we also hear from a member of Naranon, which helps family members and friends of people in recovery. And we talk with a woman who works for a treatment center in Connecticut. Are you or someone you know in the recovery community? What has it been like these last several months? My first guest is in recovery after struggling with addiction to powder and crack cocaine. He hosts the podcast Back from Broken from Colorado Public Radio. Vic, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lucy. Good morning.
I saw your sobriety anniversary tweet just the other day. How did people respond to you when you sent that out?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's just amazing. You know, too oftentimes people talk about Twitter being this awful place, you know, and it can be a negative place, but it could also be a very moving and loving place. And I mean, the replies, the text messages, the DMs, and anytime I post something like that, it's not so much for me, although I am proud of what I accomplished. It's just to kind of let others know that you can do it and that hope is possible. And so oftentimes I'll get really personal messages from people. They'll say, congratulations on your sobriety. My son just went into a treatment program, or my wife struggled with alcohol and she's now 2 years sober. I mean, it's beautiful, total strangers communicating that way. And I think that's just beautiful.
So tell us about your story, Vic. I wanted to ask first, how old were you when your addiction started?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of people, you know, I started drinking and doing some, you know, smoking weed and taking LSD and mushrooms when I was in high school, you know, following members of the Grateful Dead and Fish and things like that. But every person who becomes addicted to drugs remembers a time when the drugs didn't cause a problem and you could actually function. And for me, that was college, where I got good grades. I did internships but still went out to the bars and did all that stuff. It really wasn't until my first job out of college, which was as a sports anchor. That's when I really fell in love with cocaine. And it began as kind of a weekend thing. And then it became an everyday thing pretty soon. And pretty soon I'm not going on the air without it, you know. So I'll go into the makeup room, adjust my tie, put on my makeup and do a few rails of cocaine off the sink and go on the air. And no one was none the wiser. I mean, I did that nightly.
You would get laid off from that job in Texas, so you went back to Colorado, but your cocaine habit stayed with you.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's listening who's ever been addicted and who's in recovery understands what, you know, the geographic change. We've all tried that. We've all tried that geographic change. Like, well, if I just move to Missouri, everything will be okay, right? Like as if there's no drugs in Missouri. And it's just, that's part of the madness of addiction. But I did move back to Colorado thinking, you know, it's a good chance to time out and whatever. But as soon as I got there, you know, I looked for a dealer before I even looked for a job. And that our priorities when we are addicted to drugs, that's just what it is. Like, and there's no thought process behind it. It's kind of like when you wake up and maybe brush your teeth in the morning, me doing cocaine is just what I'm going to do. There's no thought about it.
So the cycle continued. You kept doing cocaine. You were high at work. How did your second place of employment respond?
Not well. and of course, you know, at that time, the drug and the addiction was progressing in that it was seriously impacting my personality and my behavior and my sleep cycle. So I hosted a morning show for that second job. And oftentimes, you know, as you may know, when you had to host something in the morning, you got to get up really early. And oftentimes I just wouldn't go to bed. I would stay up all night drinking and doing cocaine and then just show up to the newsroom hosting the show. And then as soon as it was over, I would just go home and crash the rest of the day, even though I still had other work to do. And, you know, I'd be barking at producers and really irritable. And finally they said, you know, we need more from you. And I couldn't do it at that time. So, I mean, so now, as you're correctly pointing out, early in my life, I'm still in my 20s at this point, mid 20s. My drug use is consuming me in ways where there are now consequences. Like I'm losing my livelihood because of it.
When I was listening to one of your episodes back from Broken Again, Vic Vella, who hosts that podcast with me here on Where We Live, you said cocaine was my master, so much so that when you had a run-in with your drug dealer, it was something that wasn't a breaking point for you.
I know. Yeah. And what you're referring to there, I owed him a lot of money. And see, we had an agreement where he would front me large quantities of cocaine. And the idea was that I would take that, sell it, you know, to friends or people who wanted little bags of coke. And I would make a profit. And not only would I make a profit, I'd be paying for my own habit. And it's like, that's brilliant. In theory, that sounds great. On paper, that sounds great, of course. But of course, in reality, what happened was I ended up doing my own product. So I was, after all, I am addicted to cocaine. So I would, but by the time the pile of coke was gone, I owed this guy several hundreds of dollars and I was ignoring his phone calls and he was threatening me over the phone. Long story short, my boyfriend at the time convinced his uncle to loan us some money. So I showed up at my dealer's door, apologizing. Yeah, I'm sorry, I was ignoring your calls, and he let me in. And as soon as he shut the door behind me, I just felt this, you know, fist to the back of my head. And what happened then was he started beating me up. He was beating me. He was kicking me. And, you know, I'm just like bruised and bloodied. And then he stood over me with a barrel of a gun. He was holding a gun as I'm laying there, you know, scared on the floor. And he's just calling me every name in the book saying, you know, I'm not going to use the words he used, but don't ever, dodge my calls again. You know, next time I'll kill you. And you know, he, after the moment passed, he put his gun away, you know, he said, okay, no hard feelings. He counted my cash. And as he's counting my cash and as I'm getting up, most people would have just walked out the door and never seen that guy again. Right. But I stood up and I said, so can you front me more drugs? That's the insanity of addiction. I literally just got beat up. And I literally just had a gun pointed to my head and I still want cocaine.
So when did you start to take it serious that you needed treatment, Vic?
It took a long time. And I think that's something a lot of people can relate to who's ever had struggles with substance use disorder or really any struggle. You know, over the years I would kind of take half measures, you know. I even went to a rehab center for 28 days, but I wasn't ready to get sober. So I got high the day I got out. You can put a treatment center on every corner of the block, but if unless you're ready, unless you're willing to get help, it's not going to do any good. And that's what happened in my case for a long time. I knew I had a problem. I just didn't do anything about it. And then there's consequences, like I mentioned, not just job loss. I was ruining relationships, burning bridges with relationships. I was in financial dire straits because cocaine, you know, was breaking news, cocaine is expensive. And, and so I'm going bankrupt. And there's health consequences too. Lucy, in my case, I was not in the summer of 2006, I was really sick all the time. And I didn't know what was going on. I felt like I had the flu in the middle of summer, and doctors didn't know what was going on until one day, one of my doctors just asked me, he said, you know, he knew my history with drugs and I'm a gay man as well. And he said, when's the last time you got tested for HIV? And as soon as he asked the question, I knew that's what was going on. And when they do the blood work, they measure a couple of things. One, they measure the viral load, which measures the presence of the virus in your body, and your T cell count, which is your immune system. And the viral load was through the roof, and my T cell count was almost nearly depleted. I was what you would call borderline AIDS, and no wonder why I was so sick. And so, but even that didn't stop me, right? I took my medicine for HIV, but I kept using, and it really wasn't until 2015 when I had enough. The cocaine use progressed from me snorting cocaine for many, many years, and to the point where I did damage to my nose and I couldn't physically snort the drug anymore. So I started smoking crack. And I did that for the last couple of years. I covered the state capitol here in Colorado. So I'm outside smoking crack behind a dumpster and then going inside and interviewing the governor, right? And that's the problem too. You point to things in your life that are going well, and so therefore you can't have a problem, right? Like, I may be smoking crack behind a dumpster, but I just interviewed the governor. Not many people can do that, right? It's the thought process that goes on when you're really suffering is really horrendous.
You mentioned 2015, Vic. There was that moment in 2015, you're sitting in your bedroom, you're listening to music, and you've reached that breaking point finally. Who did you call?
It was this guy who I made a previous attempt to get sober. He was my initial sponsor. And that previous attempt didn't last very long, but I still had his number. And I was scrolling through my phone. I'm crying on my floor. And I came across his number, and I thought, it's like 3 a.m. I haven't slept in days. I'm broke. I just smoked my last crack rock. I said, I have nothing to lose. I'm just going to give this guy a call. And mind you, he could have, deleted my number. He could be asleep, any number of things. But so when I called, he answered, and the first words out of his mouth were, "Hey Vic, how's it going?" And I just lost it. I was crying, and I said, "Hey, can you take me to a meeting in the morning?" And that was the last time I got high.
Can you describe this journey, yeah, this 6-year journey from that night that you decided enough was enough?
It's that old cliche of one day at a time, but it's so true. Like, I wouldn't have 6 years of sobriety if I didn't take my sobriety and recovery one day at a time. And I think that's what happens with a lot of folks who early in recovery who relapse. They keep thinking too far headed in the future, like, oh, how can I possibly stay sober for a month, or how can I possibly stay sober with the Super Bowl party coming up, or the my friend's wedding. Like, we keep thinking we're putting all these barriers ahead of us that are in the future. When I just stopped doing that and just literally decided I'm just going to be sober today, that's it, that's all I had to worry about. It was like the weight of the world lifted. I think I can do that. I could stay sober today. And as you put it, yeah, 6 years is a long time, but there's a reason why I never say I'm recovered in past tense. I say I'm in recovery or I'm recovering because it's a process that never ends. Just a couple weeks ago, I was struggling. It was right around the time of the Capitol riots. It wasn't because of the Capitol riots, but that didn't make things any better. There were some personal things that I messed up and I was beating myself up over. And I had a tough time, but I had to use my recovery playbook, called my sponsor and talked to friends and talked it out. And I stayed sober. You're right. It's not something that, you're sober. Okay, all my problems go away. But now you have to live life on life's terms without the luxury, if you will, of self-medicating that we did for so long. I self-medicated for so long. Well, now I got to deal with traffic like everyone else does. And now I got to deal with dating like everyone else does, but I can't get high.
You're hearing Vic Vella here on Where We Live. He hosts the podcast Back From Broken. It focuses on stories of recovery and comeback stories of people who have struggled with addiction. And that's from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to talk about what it's like to be in recovery during the pandemic. We're going to hear from a family member about services available to the recovery community. And we'll hear from a woman who works for a Connecticut treatment center. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. My guest today on Zoom, Vic Vella, who is 6 years in recovery. He has a podcast, Back From Broken, as we talk about what it's like to navigate addiction and recovery, especially in the pandemic. So, Vic, what have you been hearing from people you've interviewed, and what has it been like for you when we think about recovery, having that in-person support versus a lot of phone calls and Zoom? What's it been like?
Yeah, that's a really good question and an important one, too. You know, I think what a lot of people in recovery are missing is that person-to-person connection. So, like, if you've ever been to a recovery meeting, you know, you greet everyone, you give a hug, you know, you gather around in a circle and they pass out chips. So-and-so has 30 days sober, and everyone claps and everyone gives them a hug. And then you gather around, you know, in a circle and say a prayer, and then you bond and have coffee. You can't really do those kinds of things in Zoom because it's just all in front of a camera, right? In a computer. And it's terrific that the Zoom meetings are available, and thank goodness that they are. But that nothing can replace a hug, right? And I think that's one of the things that's really missing when it comes to the recovery community right now. You know, I'm not going to lie, a lot of people are struggling through this pandemic. And, you know, not only are we dealing with the pandemic the same way that you are, which is a lot of pain, a lot of seeing a lot of suffering, maybe someone close to you, you know, was lost, but we're having to stay sober. And so it's quite a task. And there's some people who aren't doing well, and some people who are. I, you know, it's a little both for me. You know, there's things that I really miss doing, like going and the things you don't think about. Like, I would go play basketball all the time, and that may sound trivial, but moving and exercise and sports was one of the things I did when I stopped using drugs, and it helps me in my recovery. And so when you take that away from people, it's really tough.
But is it concerning as well, Vic, when we think about so many people in isolation, when a person may accidentally overdose, that they're alone, that there's nobody there to help them?
Yeah, and that's happened. I think, you know, Google any news story and look up overdoses, and pretty much everywhere, you know, they've gone up during the pandemic. And, you know, medical advances, you know, have allowed people to bring others back from the brink, if you will, with medicine, you know, like Narcan. Mm-hmm. But if no one's there to do it, well, you know, that person could be a goner. And yeah, and I think that the, you know, in my case, when cocaine is usually a social drug, like you do a bunch of cocaine, you go dance with your friends and stay up all night and talk. But as the addiction progressed, I became more isolated in my use. And so instead of being social, I would shut off my phone, close the curtains, you know, close myself off to the world and get high alone. And so for me, oftentimes my default setting is when I think of isolation, I think of getting high. And so then what am I going to do to not do that? And that's, you know, the things I talked about earlier, which is making sure I have a sponsor at the ready, making sure I have friends I can call anytime, meetings I can jump into whenever I want. And again, thank goodness those things are there for me and others.
I wanted to bring into our conversation Alex Helfer. She's Chief Clinical Officer at Mountainside. This is a national behavioral health network that provides alcohol and drug addiction treatment. And Mountainside has centers in the towns of Canaan and Wilton, Connecticut. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
I wanted you to respond to Vic's story, especially what he has been hearing from others in recovery in the pandemic, the difficulties of staying connected, but also maybe some of the bright spots, as he mentioned, looking at technology and advances and still in a way to stay connected.
Yes. So what we have found kind of relates exactly to what he was talking about. And while virtual and telehealth has been something that we are fortunate to have, there's no real substitution for in-person is what we have found. And our clients are really craving that. However, virtual has allowed us to reach more people at the same time. So we have, you know, free support groups for the public. And instead of having 4 to 8 people show up at a location, we're able to have 32 to 40 show up at one night. And so there's pros and cons, definitely. But I do agree that there's not a lot of substitution for the actual connection that in person allows and getting out of the house. But it is a benefit in some aspects that when you're traveling, you can still engage. If people are traveling, when you're at home, you know, there's really no excuse to not hop on either a meeting or a clinical session. You know, you don't have much to put much effort into it. So there's pros and cons to both.
When we think about the pandemic, more people isolated, more people dealing with stress that they may not have had mm-hmm. before the pandemic, whether it's job loss or lost pay, their family members or friends have fallen sick. That can be a lot for people. I'm wondering what you have seen in our state with the addiction in the pandemic. Has it gotten worse?
It has definitely gotten worse. And Vic spoke to this about opioid deaths, you know, increasing. And I was on Department of Public Health in Connecticut's website, and it just showed from 2019 to 2020, with the same January to July months, overdoses have increased by 20% in our state. And so the opioid epidemic, which is really a pandemic at the same time, has where we thought we were making progress, you know, in years past, this year has really just set us back to square one almost with a 20% increase, a huge increase from the year prior. I also notice at our facility, alcoholism rates have increased. We've had a 20% increase of alcoholism being the primary drug of choice that we treat in our detox versus what used to be a 50-50 split with opiates and alcohol. So while opioid deaths are on the rise, alcohol use is also on the rise.
When we think about addiction, again, there's been so much attention on the opioid epidemic because of the number of, mm-hmm. of overdose deaths around our country, including here in Connecticut. But often it seems that alcohol addiction is overlooked. And I'm wondering, Alex, in your perspective as Chief Clinical Officer at Mountainside, are you serving people who maybe their relationship with alcohol was better managed before the pandemic, but now because of all these added stresses, it's become an issue?
Yes, I definitely have seen that and feel that, as we don't have as many statistics yet because the pandemic is still ongoing. I think we're actually going to see even more alcohol-related treatment once things start opening up again and if people go back to the office. Right now, there's really no major consequences for alcohol use. In terms of, like, people aren't going to bars and hanging out as much. They're not, so there eliminates the DUI potential that often prompts people to enter treatment. You know, if two parents are at home potentially, then they're not worried about one drinking while watching the children or one sober. And so also showing up to work, it's a lot easier to show up to work at your home after a night of drinking than it is to show up to an office and have people notice. So I think right now people are still able to, you know, drink and function as society is allowing them to with these stay-at-home orders. And I think once those are lifted, we're going to see an increase in people realizing that they need treatment for alcohol.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, we're talking about how people are navigating addiction and recovery in the pandemic. Addiction affects families and other loved ones, too. There are groups like Naranon to help people who are supporting loved ones struggling with addiction or who are in recovery. Joining us now is a Hamden, Connecticut resident, Maxine Albert, who is part of Naranon. Maxine, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
I was asking Alex about how services, treatment services, and programs have changed in the pandemic, but I'm wondering from your perspective as an organization and a member helping those people who need support because there might be someone in their family or close friend that's struggling, how have you been able to still keep that connection going in the pandemic?
Well, similar to what both Vic and Alex were talking about, I just wanted to say I'm not any kind of a professional. I'm just a member of Naranon Family Groups. But what we have been seeing is that it's very difficult because we also like being live. We like being able to give hugs, as Vic was talking about, being able to comfort family members when they come in, letting them know they're not alone. And it's very difficult to do on the virtual scene. However, I have to really say that for some bizarre reason, the Naranon family group seem to have grown since the pandemic. There is several meetings that, because people don't have to drive, they're able to just log on any time of the day. Naranon is a worldwide fellowship. We're international, so we have virtual meetings all over the world. People can log on to a meeting any time of the day in any part of the world. So they can find that recovery, they can find that recovery and the comfort from family members online. However, it's still not the same thing as in person, but there are people that are finding us because of the pandemic, which is absolutely crazy.
Tell me why you joined Naranon, Maxine.
Well, I thought I came in because the person that I was involved with was actively using drugs. What I found out when I came in here was that many of my relationships were all affected by the disease of addiction. Coming in here, I thought I was coming in here to help the addict. And what Naranon does is it helps the family member, family, and we're family and friends. It doesn't just have to be a family member. But we're here to help ourselves deal with loving an addict and knowing that we are totally powerless over helping them, that we cannot get the addict clean until the addict is ready to get clean. That's the only way that can help them. They have to do it themselves. So we're here to help ourselves. We learn how to either live with addiction or deal with the consequences of their actions and not being able to fix them. We keep the focus on ourselves, and there's nothing that we can do to help them. So I came in here because of somebody I loved was an active addict. I stay because the recovery process is all about me today.
When we think about support, is the general feeling that families and loved ones of someone who's struggling with addiction, that they are overlooked from society, Maxine?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we are just as crazy as the addict. And because we're trying to fix and help and take care of somebody else, but we can't. And they do say, I don't know the statistics because it's just not my thing, but they say for every addict, 4 people in the family are affected. But, you know, I'm sure it's way more than that. And I'm sure Alex could probably give you those statistics. However, what we are here to do is to let people know they're not alone. They're, you know, this disease is filled with guilt and shame, not just for the addict, but for the family members. We're like, why is that happening? What could we have done? What are people thinking that we couldn't fix the addict? Why did we allow that when people that are not affected by the disease don't understand that there's nothing that we can do? And until you're affected by this disease and come into or be familiar with the 12-step program, you know, you think, oh, we can fix this, and we can't.
Vic Vela, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation because you are someone in recovery. I didn't ask you earlier about the impact on your family. How are they doing?
Well, first of all, everything that Maxine said is right. And thank God for groups like Nalanon or Al-Anon or other family support groups, because I always put it this way. It's that obviously the addiction was tough on me. You know, it was terrible. But what I put my family through was so much worse in so many ways. Like my mom and dad, those sleepless nights where they didn't know if they were going to get a phone call at 2 a.m. from the morgue or a police officer. That's heck, you know, living through that is just awful. So thank goodness there are support groups for family members, because again, we can't get help unless we're willing and able to get help. But to answer your question, they're so proud of me, and I love them, and I'm so grateful for the love and support that they have given me over the last 6 years and well, you know, 43 years. and it's, and you know, that's the one thing, is that even though we can't really fix someone unless they're willing to get help, but we can tell them that we love them. You can call and say, I'm here for you whenever you need something. I'm just letting you know, I love you. And we will remember that when we're ready. When we're ready to ask for help, we're going to remember all those times when people said, I love you.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're going to come back after a short break. And if you are in the recovery community, we want to hear from you too. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. We're talking about addiction and recovery in the pandemic with my guests on Zoom, Vic Vela, the host of Back From Broken, a podcast about recovery and comeback stories from Colorado Public Radio. Alex Helfer is here, Chief Clinical Officer at Mountainside, a treatment facility with centers in Canaan and Wilton, Connecticut. And Maxine Albert, a member of Naranon Family Groups. She lives in Hamden, Connecticut. Maxine, when people reach out to you, how do they find you? And what do you want them to know, especially as this pandemic continues?
Well, they don't necessarily find me. We have a website, and our world website has links to all the groups all over the world. So they can just click on and they can find normally a regular meeting, but now they'll find the virtual meeting link so that they can come on. We used to go through, way before a website, we used to go through InfoLine through 211. But we also do a lot of speaking at different rehabs, which unfortunately, because of the pandemic, we cannot do it now, because as Alex was saying, they're so limited with people coming in. I have reached out to some of the rehabs that we usually speak at, but right now they're not even doing anything virtually. So we try to carry the message of hope and that there is hope for the families by speaking out to the families. But we do do, well, before pandemic, we used to do health fairs. We have a big community from Narcotics Anonymous in Connecticut, at least, that's very embracing to Naranon. And they're always welcoming us to anything that they're involved in. And so we're able to carry the message of recovery there as well. But today, I would just say it's probably based all on website. That's how people find us. They probably go on the link to find out how to get help for the addict. And fortunately, there's a way to divert them to get help for themselves. So that's the most important thing, is how to get help for ourselves. Yeah. And yes, something that Vic said that it struck me, we are very cognizant of saying to the addicts, you know, we love you. We're here for you. When you're ready to get support, we'll help you. But until then, there's nothing more we can do. And we do try to remember to tell people that we do love them, because that's important to know, to let them know that.
We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to go back to Alex Helfer from Mountainside. When we talk about recovery, relapse is part of that journey. Can you talk about how your clients navigate that and how you provide support to families?
Sure. Definitely relapse is unfortunately part of the journey. And it doesn't have to be, but it often is. And so we try to educate families on that as much as possible when we are working with them without also disheartening them, especially if it's someone's first time in treatment. But often we, you know, we do see people coming in and out of treatment facilities. And I don't know at this time how much the pandemic will impact that. However, I'm also concerned that after the pandemic, we may see, or even during the pandemic, we may see people who have had many years of sobriety relapsing more than normal due to the added stresses of the pandemic and just the isolation itself. So that is a concern.
Vic Vella, I wanted to ask you, for someone who may be listening, who either is struggling with addiction or there's someone that they love that's struggling, what would you tell them?
Never give up. Don't give up on yourself. You know, it took me a very long time. You know, people say you're doing so well and congratulations, and that's wonderful. But it took me a long time. I didn't wake up one day and say, I'm going to get sober. No, it was a lot of pain and a lot of suffering for a long time. And so I get it. And boy, I'm just, when you do make that realization that you can't, you know, that you've become, your life has become unmanageable because of drugs and alcohol, and that road to recovery begins, you know, your life can change in ways that you can't even imagine right now. I'm telling you, yeah, take everything one day at a time, but understand that there is hope and that there is a possibility for a spiritual awakening. And when that happens, it is a beautiful feeling. And it's unlike anything else that I could ever describe, like a child being born, right? Or something. And in many ways, we are reborn when we start over, because I'm learning how to behave in the real world without drugs. So in many ways, I'm kind of a kindergartner still, right? Just learning right from wrong. But I'm telling you, don't beat yourself up. We all are broken from time to time. We all need help from time to time. Trust me, if you have a sad story, I will match you mine or anyone else's. There's people who have recovered who have been in prison, people who have taken the lives of others, right? You know, if you are still above the ground, you got a chance.
You talk about everyone being broken in some way or the other, and I thought that was so powerful listening to your podcast, Vic, called Back from Broken, letting people talk about the recovery, their comeback stories. And I really appreciate your time today here on Where We Live, Vic.
Hey, thank you. And thanks to Maxine and Alex for your contributions. You guys are terrific. Thank you for what you guys do.
That's Vic Vello from Colorado Public Radio. Also with us today on Where We Live was Alex Helfer, Chief Clinical Officer at Mountainside, and Maxine Albert, a member of Naranon Family Groups. Alex and Maxine, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us. It's an important topic to keep discussing.
And we'll have some links on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Today's show was produced by Tess Terrible. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.